Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, July 12th. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we take a closer look at the latest report that tracks patients who are choosing medically assisted suicide. What do the trends show? We highlight a program that is giving the gift of sight. WikiVision is looking for patients suffering from cataracts who can't afford the simple surgery. And with hot summer temperatures gripping cities around the globe, we revisit a cooler interview we did a year ago with a photographer about the sound of ice. Plus, athletes age 55 and older are suddenly in high demand for a local fitness competition. We'll learn why. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. For the past 5 years, state health officials have been tracking a program that allows terminally ill patients to obtain a prescription to end their lives should they so choose. A new report out on the Our Care, Our Choice Act shows the latest statistics across the state. We talked to the Chief Policy Officer for the Department of Health's Office of Planning, Policy, and Program Development. Here's Lauren Kim with what the numbers tell us.
There are about 9,500 deaths a year in Hawaii, and I don't know how many of them are because of a very terminal disease, and it's just nice that people know what options are out there, give them a sense of empowerment, and it's nice to have choices at that stage in your life. So, yeah, the opportunity to speak about this is very much appreciated.
What is the big takeaway for you? I mean, you know, now we have this data.
I think the big takeaway being 5 years into this program is that healthcare providers appear to be more aware and more comfortable with fulfilling the roles of medical aid in dying. It was very difficult that first year to recruit, is not the right word. It was very difficult that first year to convince providers that they had a very critical role to play at the end of one of their patients' lives. That took quite a bit of workshopping, focus grouping, carefully listening to healthcare providers. Many of them said, this is not what the Hippocratic Oath means. I didn't go to medical school to help people die. So it was a very difficult personal and professional choice. The value of the Our Care, Our Choice Act is that it protects providers who follow all of the steps from prosecution or other legal consequences. So it provides them safe harbor within which to help their patients make decisions about the end of their life when they have a terminal illness.
The data that you have, you know, what does it show?
The data that we have show very much an upward trend in patients participating in the Our Care, Our Choice Act or medical aid in dying. We had 23 patient deaths in 2019, 32 the year after, 49 in 2021, 55 in 2022, and 76. And the department's press release described the fact that that's a 50% increase over last year. So patients are becoming more aware, providers are becoming more comfortable facilitating medical aid in dying.
And there are a number of cases where the medication is prescribed, but that the patients opted not to use it.
That's correct. We do not have hard data on how many patients who were prescribed the medication died without ingesting it. Generally speaking, across states who have medical aid in dying programs, the working number is about 2/3 ingest, 1/3 do not. So they die either of their underlying illness or some other reason. That said, it is universally reported anecdotally that even though patients do not ingest the medication, they take great comfort in knowing that it's there, that they have another option, that they have a sense of control over a time in their life where an illness may be exerting more control over their lives than the patient's will.
I remember, you know, as we were going through this legislation and debating the pros and the cons, that was one of the arguments, is it would give them peace of mind at the end, whether or not they choose to take it.
That has certainly been our feedback anecdotally reported from attending and consulting providers. So I think it is an inexpensive price to pay for peace of mind during a period of time in a patient's life where things aren't going so well. So just to have that sense of control, that they have an option that, if they so choose, can beat the disease, I think is very comforting for the patients and their families.
But what happens to that medication if it's not used? You know, what were the safeguards that were written into the law?
The best practice would be to have it professionally disposed of. So medications that are not ingested or not completely ingested should not be sitting around in someone's bathroom cabinet. Hopefully it is already secure, meaning that children, young children or others will not have immediate access to it or easy access to it. But if a patient dies from not ingesting the medication, there are drug take-back days funded by opioid settlement money, and there almost always are opioids involved in the medication cocktail that is used in medical aid in dying, and it should be professionally disposed of. The Department of Health has links on its website and a schedule for when these drug take-back events take place.
But should we be doing more management over those cases?
I think there's an opportunity for the Department of Health to educate providers, to perhaps circle back with the families. Unfortunately, the data that the department collects isn't necessarily immediately reported. So there is a lag about when the provider submits the report in. Sometimes there's some back and forth, but we have no hard data. It's not a requirement of the Medical Aid in Dying Law to report whether a patient ingested or not.
Do the hospitals keep track of that kind of thing?
The hospitals have better records and better data than the Department of Health does. Still, if a patient expires in the peace of their own home rather than in a facility like a hospice, it's going to be very difficult. It is more problematic to obtain that data because of privacy laws. When you look on, for example, the death certificate, it will just have the underlying illness. It will not say, you know, ingestion of DDMA or DDMP medication related to medical aid in dying.
Is there anything else that you think is important to underscore as we look at the data that comes in?
One of the other bright spots in an otherwise potentially a grim episode in a family's life with a patient with terminal illness is that we're seeing more providers participate in the neighbor islands. The first year was really highly Oahu-centric, and it still is Oahu-centric. There were some physicians who are based in Honolulu who would fly out to the neighbor islands to act as an attending or consulting provider. But we have seen neighbor island providers really step up. And there have been at least one participant on all the major islands. So we're very grateful that some of our neighbor island ohana have the opportunity to exercise this legal right for medical aid in dying. The other point I'd like to make is the department urges anybody who is even considering medical aid in dying to begin speaking with your healthcare provider immediately. The amendments that have been enacted to the original medical aid in dying largely consist of reducing the waiting time or creating waivers in case the provider believes the patient will expire prior to the medical aid in dying process being complete. That's a very sad and tragic story. Many patients walk in and are given less than 6 months to live, and it's even potentially 3 months they may expire. So start early, enroll in hospice, explore with your healthcare provider all the end-of-life choices that you have. That is probably the number one piece of advice from the Department of Health, is begin discussing this with your healthcare provider as soon as possible.
And as far as the underlying, you know, causes or diseases, I mean, cancer is still pretty much up there, right?
It is the overwhelmingly most frequently reported illness, yes. Underlying illness is cancer of all kinds.
And is there anything else that we are looking at legislatively? You know, I mean, we're still only one of a handful of states that, you know, does have this law on the book. Was there anything this past session or anything, any tweaking that needs to be done on the laws right now, either better reporting or anything else?
The Medical Aid in Dying Law has been amended every other year or so since its enactment in response to some of the anecdotal and hard data experiences of providers. Many healthcare providers reported that given their experience, they can walk into a room and tell this patient is not going to make the waiting period. And so in response to that, legislation was introduced to reduce the waiting time or create a waiver when clearly a patient is not going to make it. There has been some discussion about the efficacy of mental health counseling, but I think we need more hard data as to whether the mental health consultation adds value or prolongs unnecessarily the process or other. One of the observations that surprised us was the demographic breadth of patients who avail themselves of this right. The conventional wisdom holds that folks with college degrees, advanced degrees, who, you know, are more comfortable challenging the system, quote unquote, will access this right. However, we were pleasantly surprised to see folks from all walks of life all demographics, all education levels successfully navigate their way through this process. So that has been very gratifying. That said, insurance doesn't necessarily cover some of the medication, and the medication may cost an individual between $400 and $800. So there are opportunities to assure equity among patients, both in their access to healthcare providers and this program, as well as access to the medication.
That was Lauren Kim, Chief Policy Officer with the State Department of Health. Hawaii is only one of 11 states that has approved a medical aid in dying program. We will have a link to that report that was just released this week on the conversation page of our website after the show.
On the next Science Friday, the queen conch is a beautiful and iconic resident of Caribbean waters.
But the popularity of the shells and the tastiness of the meat led them to be overfished.
Inside a massive effort to bring back queen conch from the brink. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
It is startling to think that 20 million people worldwide are blind because of cataracts. Here in Hawaii, a group called WikiVision has helped more than 100 people with free surgery to correct their vision. The brother-sister co-founding team of Alec and Arabella Tan are behind the student-led nonprofit. It has raised over $100,000 and aims to help another 20 cataract patients this fall. Arabella is a junior at Iolani School and is taking over as her brother heads to college. She joined the conversations Lillian Song in our studios recently.
It started originally in 2020 during COVID. My brother had a service project when he was at Iolani a couple years before that, and he got the idea to start this nonprofit in order to give back to the community.
Is that part of the mission? Important that it be student-led?
Yes, because we think that no matter the age, people are able to accomplish things and give back to the community. So cataracts happen when the lens of the eye clouds over, and this happens to everyone as they get older. It costs anywhere from $6,000 to $10,000 for people with no insurance. Many people can't afford the cost of this surgery, and so WikiVision helps to fund the cost.
Okay. How many students are involved in this?
We currently have 6 high school students who are part of our team. We also have an adult board of directors who help guide us. We, through clinics from all over the island, we help find these people who are uninsured and who can't afford the surgery even though they need it. And we work with surgeons and the Eye Surgery Center of Hawaii in order to find the different anesthesiologists and nurses and staff. There's quite a lot of people involved on our surgery days, yeah.
Wow, and you guys, the student staff, are organizing all of this?
Most of the logistics on the surgery day are organized by the Eye Surgery Center. That's not in our hands, but spreading the word and raising awareness and talking with the patients. We get to know the patients personally most of the time, so that is facilitated by the students, but the actual logistics are adult-run.
If I'm listening today and this sounds like I can benefit from this, or perhaps somebody in my family could benefit from this, how do I apply and see if I can be a part of the next surgery day that's coming up?
Yeah. So on our website, wikivision.info, we have forms available for people who may be in need of cataract surgery.
what are the things that I have to check off in order to qualify to be helped by WikiVision?
There's not many qualifications, honestly. If someone has cataracts that are impairing their vision and they need to have this surgery, then most of the time we will try to help them.
Okay. Surgery itself is quite costly, $6,000 and above. How are you guys financing this?
So most of our fundraising comes from our online fundraising campaign. And this year, we also have our fourth annual fundraising concert, which will be held on August 24th at Iolani School.
What are you doing at the fundraiser that is allowing so much of the community to help donate to the cause?
Well, since our campaign is online, I think it's really easy to spread the word. Also, the concert helps as well with that. Although we're still working on getting more support for our concert,
okay.
As this is only the second year that we've done an in-person concert because of COVID.
So when you guys first did the fundraising concert, all the music was performed online?
Yes, it was online. So we had clips from all over the nation, honestly, through our different connections,
mm-hmm.
and we did a YouTube concert online.
Wow, so you've come far. So now this year it's going to be in person.
Yes. Right now we have a sextet performing. We also have harp players, piano players. It'll be a fun concert.
Okay, and it's coming up?
August 24th at Iolani School.
Okay. But before that, I was seeing some deadlines for July 24th. Appointments have to be scheduled by. The screenings will happen July 27th. So help me understand this. What is screening? So basically just saying, hey, you qualify because you don't have insurance. You can come to the office to see if your cataracts are worthy of surgery.
Yes, the screening day is for taking a preliminary look at the patient's eyes and confirming that their cataracts need to be operated on.
I see. What are your interests as far as, are you going to pursue medicine? Are you going to also follow this path of doing eye surgery?
I still need to figure that out. I think medicine is really interesting and there's so many different fields,
mm-hmm.
but I'm still debating between that and a different area.
Yeah. But since you and your brother did start WikiVision from the ground up, it was a COVID project started back in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
What spurred you to then go into offering free cataract surgeries?
Because our mom is an ophthalmologist, and we've just been hearing stories as we've grown up of people who have needed this cataract surgery and have recovered from it and been able to see. Because cataracts can cause blindness a lot of the time, and being able to restore this vision with an effective surgery is an amazing thing. And so we thought that it would be great to be able to offer this to our community.
I see. And with these surgeries, since you've helped so many people, can you share with our listeners one of the success stories or one of the people that you have helped that WikiVision has helped to kind of illustrate, you know, it's a simple surgery. I mean, technology has advanced.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also allowing people who are obstructed by finances.
Yeah, so definitely one of the most profound stories was from our mission trip to Tecate, Mexico. So in 2022, WikiVision team members, we went on a trip to Mexico and we worked with several ophthalmologists or eye surgeons there to help members in that community over there receive cataract surgery. And we were able to help 20 people in total. One of them that stood out, his name was Ildefonso, and he came into the clinic completely blind with cataracts in both eyes. So he had to have a walking cane and he had to have someone guide him in. And after his surgery, he was able to see completely. And so he actually gifted his cane to the surgeons there because he didn't need it anymore. And so he walked out of the clinic by himself for the first time in years. And that was just an amazing thing to see for me because the moment that we took off the eye patch, he could see again, and it was honestly amazing.
That is a wonderful gift. I think we just take it for granted.
We do.
That our eyes are going to see the world around us. But once that is taken away from you, or once you start aging, cataracts set in, and then not having that ability to address it and living with the worsening vision for so long and to eventually become blind, that is, like you said, an amazing story to share. So how long was that process, though? So you guys were in Mexico on a mission trip,
yes,
to do this. How long is that process to do the surgery and then to say it was a success and you've got your vision back?
A lot of the time, it's extremely fast. So the surgery doesn't take very long. And even in a case like that where it was so severe, it was the next day, I think, he was already able to see some vision. He went from seeing nothing to at least light or movement. So it was incredible, honestly.
Wow. Okay. So right now you are a rising junior.
Yes.
What would you like to share with other people who might be interested, who are of your age, to do something similar in giving back to the community? Are there wisdoms that you have learned over the past 4 years as you've been part of leadership at WikiVision?
I would say to not get discouraged from setbacks or from thinking things are impossible. Because when we began, it was in the middle of COVID and the variants were coming out. So on our first surgery day, we were scheduled to have over 20 patients come. And at the end, we only had 8 patients come because of the fears of COVID. And that was a little bit demoralizing. But as the years went by, we didn't give up and we kept going. And we went from 8 to 20, and last year, over the course of the year, we did almost 40 patients. And so I would just say to keep your eyes on your goal and not to be discouraged by any setbacks.
That was Arabella Tan talking with HPR's Lillian Song. Tan co-founded the nonprofit WikiVision with her brother Alec. She is working with 5 other teens to identify 20 patients in need of cataract surgery. July 24th is the deadline to schedule a screening appointment. An online fundraising campaign is underway with plans for a concert in August at Iolani School. We'll share links on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company serving the island since 2005, committed to providing personal service to each customer, featuring a locally based customer care team. Learn more at mobi.com.
Cosmo Sheldrake's music blends field recordings of the natural world with his own improvisation, bringing together the human and animal realms he believes have a lot in common.
It always just seemed clear to me that animals had cultures, that they inherit language in similar ways, that they're highly conscious beings like us.
Cosmo Sheldrake performs on the next World Cafe.
Beginning this evening at 8.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today, we're taking a trip around the baseball diamond. In 1944, more than 300 Major League Baseball players and thousands of minor league players had enlisted in military service. While Major League teams played out their seasons, service teams consisting of some of America's top baseball talent also sprung up. An Air Force team based out of Honolulu featured one Sergeant Joe DiMaggio. In a game against a Navy team that year, DiMaggio hit a home run off of a young pitcher named Max Patkin, who had pitched in the minor leagues for the White Sox. As DiMaggio trotted around the bases, Patkin threw down his glove in mock anger, then followed the Hall of Famer around the bases, mimicking his run. And from that, a career in baseball comedy was born. After the war, Patkin performed at packed stadiums in the majors, where he was known to mock the first baseman's warm-up routine and take long drinks of water and spout out geysers. Our backyard quiz for today is, can you tell us what Max Patkin's nickname was? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HBR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing Kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
The recent scorching temperatures across Europe and around the U.S. reminds us that climate change continues to impact our planet, especially in Antarctica. Just ask photographer Enzo Baracco. The story goes that when he was there, he nearly jumped out of his skin when part of a glacier collapsed near where he was taking pictures, hence the name of his book, The Noise of Ice. Baracco went from high fashion photography to a nature adventurer inspired by an early Irish scientific expedition. He found a muse in Mother Nature and is now a man on a mission. We caught up with him last year when he was on Oahu before fellow explorer Mark Blackburn began taking him around. Baracco was the guest speaker for the local chapter of the Explorers Club, where he shared his adventures in the Antarctic and more recently the Galapagos. Here's a rebroadcast of that interview. Antarctica, what an incredible place to explore. And Enzo has spent some time there.
Definitely was a change in my career. I was like a fashion photographer before when I was living in London. And very, very accidentally, I discovered the story of Ernest Shackleton. He's like an incredible, he was an incredible explorer. Immediately when I read these words, I totally sink in his story, you know. And that inspired me so much to organize my own expedition in Antarctica. And definitely when I come back, everything was changed. So now what I do is I just create a project about conservation and sustainability and help a company to communicate the commitment they have about the natural world through my work. It was an incredible privilege for Antarctica have the foreword of my book, The Noise of Ice, the legendary Sir Ranulph Fiennes. Is like an incredible privilege of him on the board. And of course, Vogue Italia, because I always bring with me my fashion background. Like, for example, like my new project now, my latest project is like about Galapagos. And for this, I involve also like a lot of institution and museum, but also Prada is very interesting in communicate again the commitment about our natural resource, natural world. And so basically like that is like what also I'd like to do in Hawaii. So I'm very excited to unlock the message of this kind of incredible islands.
As I was looking at the images online, you know, from your book, I was struck at
kind of the similarities of nature and fashion. It's Mother Nature and she's got all her finery. I mean, I just remember one image that I saw of a glacier with, you know, a fringe of icicles and it just looked lovely.
It's interesting. I think you mentioned probably the cover of the book. And that is very interesting because the cover of the book is all of my work have two editorial lines. Collector, like for the beauty of the imaging, and science see the evidence of what is climate changing. In fact, that the photo is very beautiful, everyone like, but actually is the evidence of climate changing because that the iceberg fighting to survive. That was like an upside down iceberg. And what you see in the photo was just like 2 days before was underwater. For this very unusual shape. And if I arrived like 2 days after, basically was totally flat. So I was very lucky. In fact, when I come back in London, I showed to British Antarctica Survey. At the time, I was like one of the people involved for Antarctica. They never see something like that. They tell me exactly what it was. I said, it was so beautiful, but actually it's the evidence the iceberg tried to find to survive. Because basically when the iceberg melt, lose the point of balance and rotate to asset herself. That was very, when I know that, it was very, very impressed to see that, a witness that from my eye.
So this really launched you on this activism for conservation to protect our natural resources.
Raise awareness through my work, through photography, and about the natural world we have. My goal is like try to give like a surprise with the natural world because we take it so much for granted. And I hope my work inspire people to connect.
And you must be excited to go.
Angel is the vice chair of the local chapter.
Oh,
so I
want
to put a shout out to her. So it's exciting. I'm excited to work with Enzo when he's here. I'm excited to work with the National Worldwide Explorer Club. It's quite a privilege. And we do a lot of interesting projects. So this would be actually my second flag expedition. The first flag expedition I did to Southern Laos in Fiji a number of years back.
And then so with this idea that, you know, Enzo is going to be creating a new project around Hawaii, I mean, I don't know, are you sending him places?
I've got a full schedule. So we're off to the Big Island for one night and we got a full schedule while he's here. And so we're just exploring ideas. I mean, obviously, after spending 42 years in Hawaii, I know a lot of interesting places, interesting people. So we're looking for just unusual experiences and the real soul of Hawaii, which sometimes is not seen.
And so what are you looking forward to?
I don't look for nothing in particular. I hope the island surprise me and I'm open to see what the beauty of this beautiful island want to give it to me. With the nature, it's difficult to make a plan. You know, it's always you need to work with the natural timing of the nature. And this was my approach in Antarctica. This was my approach in Galapagos. Definitely, I will do this the kind of approach also in Hawaii. So I just want, I'm open to see what the nature allowed me to record and always with the timing of the nature and with the respect of the nature.
So you let the place speak to you.
Exactly. Like, but I'm so excited because for the geographical position of Hawaii is very incredible. It's very incredible. Like we have like the most big volcano in the world. It's like incredible in the middle of like Pacific. It's so exciting to start.
Are you a good swimmer?
I'm a free diver.
Yeah. Okay.
So definitely... the ocean is, you know, quite my element. So I love it. I grew up by the Mediterranean. The ocean gave me so much. And now it's time to give it back to the ocean. And this is why all my work is around the ocean. You know, I started for Antarctica. Of course, Antarctica influenced all the current in the world. And not just that. Galapagos also, like, for the incredible story of Charles Darwin, helped us to understand the so much about our evolution, and now Hawaii, you know, for one of the more remote islands in the world and in the middle of a very important marina life crossing.
We are fortunate that we have pretty temperate weather here. You know, the rest of the world is baking, you know, with record temperatures. But we're starting to feel the effects here. You know, Mark, you've seen, we've had our share of unusual...
Very unusual climate events. And I just came from Texas, and it was 121 degrees. And it's oppressing, you know. So it's nice to get off the plane here, come back, and have such beautiful weather. And, you know, every day I'm amazed because I'm a real cloud person, just to look up in the sky and look at the beautiful clouds and the horizons. And I think most people miss that, right? We're very, very lucky to have that experience here.
So. I am struck when I drive around, even though I'm sitting in traffic, I look up and, you know, whether it's the Kotlaus or the Waianae mountain range, you can't help but just be so impressed by the beauty here. And sometimes I have to stop and pull out my camera. I know I shouldn't be doing it, but it's just breathtaking.
It is. And everybody's got such busy lives here. They rarely take the time out. And just look up at the sky and see the beautiful skyline, the clouds. I mean, I'm a very big cloud person. Of course, Constable was the first painter to ever paint clouds, really, and understand clouds. But the clouds, the horizon lines here are always amazing. You're never disappointed.
I think that we have a great opportunity to have fresh eyes on our island state, you know, and then coming from the places that you have, I'd be curious to see, you know, what you put together and what speaks to you as you look around the island.
It's very interesting. Me too. Because like as we think, we know nature is always have the capacity to surprise you. When I was in Antarctica, I thought, I said, nothing can surprise me in the natural world because what I witnessed, what happened, it was very incredible. But when I go to Galapagos, immediately I realized I was wrong. So, and now I have the same kind of approach with Hawaii, and definitely Hawaii will surprise me once again.
What I love is when you drive around at different times of the day, the light just really makes the island sparkle in so many ways that, you know, you can drive by the same mountain range or a stretch of beach, but when you see it in a different light, it's just magic.
It's all about atmospherics. And I think a lot of people, it's lost on a lot of people because it's just so crazy. Everybody's crazy busy, the traffic and everything. But if everybody would just take 10 seconds out and look around and look at the atmospherics, look at the light, look at the clouds, look at the horizon lines, and it's very, you know, very contemplative, and it's very settling, right?
Go outside, go explore where you live.
And take attention and look the nature, because that is what we miss, as Mark said, we miss the connection. In my opinion, this is why my work try to, in a very small scale, try to raise awareness about the beauty of our natural world. But I think I totally agree with Mark, like we forget to take time to look at the nature, and very simple that.
Well, the best muse is Mother Nature.
I totally Absolutely. Agree with you.
All right. Well, thank you so much, gentlemen, for carving out some time of your day and visiting with us. And we'll look forward to your project.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was explorer Mark Blackburn and photographer Enzo Baracco. They were talking with us back in July of 2023 about a project that the noted photographer is working on here in the islands.
On the next Fresh Air.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
That's one of the most famous lines from the 1974 film Chinatown. We remember Robert Towne, who wrote the Academy Award-winning screenplay, and artist, actor, comic, and musician Martin Mull, who was known for his droll, esoteric humor, by listening back to our interviews with them. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following Science Friday.
Two big Supreme Court decisions will fundamentally change how federal agencies operate in the economy. What can we learn from the past?
Before the 1920s, I'd say, there was not that many administrative agencies. They didn't touch American life that much.
I'm Amy Scott, The View from History, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Now it's time to hit the answer to today's backyard quiz, Out of the Park. Earlier, we told you about the life and career of Max Patkin, a professional funny man who performed comedic routines at baseball games for decades. He got a start in comedy in Honolulu in 1944 when he faced and mocked the legendary slugger Joe DiMaggio. After leaving the Navy in 1945, Patkin pitched 5 games in the minor leagues before a career-ending shoulder injury. But as the saying goes, when one door closes, another opens. Patkin became a baseball clown and took his routine around the country, donning a jersey with a question mark on the back and wearing a sideways cap. By his own estimate, he made more than 4,000 appearances at baseball parks over the course of his career. At times, he involved baseball legends like Yogi Berra and drank Howard in his silly routines. If you remember Patkin's nickname, then you know he was known as the Clown Prince of Baseball, which was the answer to today's backyard quiz. But you know what? We have no winners. We stumped you on that one. That's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The 2024 CrossFit Games, often called the Olympics of Fitness, kicks off next month in Texas. Hundreds of athletes from around the world will compete for the title of Fittest on Earth. Around the same time, a different kind of CrossFit competition will be held here on Oahu. It's called a WOD for the Ages, which stands for a workout of the day. 4-person teams made up of various ages will compete against each other. Teams must have 2 male and 2 female athletes, and each member must fall into one of these 4 age ranges: under 30, 31 to 44, 45 to 54, and 55 and older. Because there are fewer CrossFitters over the age of 50, older athletes have become more valuable to those looking to form a team. The Conversation's Russell Subiono and Maddie Bender made a trip to CrossFit Hawaii to learn more about the competition.
You might have an idea in your head of what I look like, but one thing you might not expect is that I'd be able to lift 135 pounds over my head. It's a CrossFit move called a power snatch. And for 5 years, I was pretty into the sport. My producer, Maddie Bender, and I, we recently went down to CrossFit Hawaii after I learned of a unique twist they were bringing to a standard CrossFit competition. They call it WOD for the Ages, which is a play on words in a couple of different ways, as I explained to Maddie.
WOD is workout of the day.
Workout of the day.
Yeah, WOD.
W-O-O-D?
Yeah.
Or just W-O-D?
W-O-D, yeah. Workout of the day. So the WOD is the prescribed workout that everybody does in a CrossFit class, and it's usually the thing that you do all day.
Okay.
Like every class does the same WOD all day. Okay. So the name of the competition is WOD for the Ages.
And ages is a double entendre.
Yes. So there's a unique aspect to this competition involving age. Oh,
and how's it?
Good to see you.
Thank you. Oh, you're welcome.
That's Ann Namba. Yes, the Ann Namba. Local fashion designer extraordinaire, also a world-class CrossFit competitor. She met up with us at CrossFit Hawaii to introduce us to the gym's owner, Kimo Kockelman.
Kimo. Russell.
Nice to meet you.
CrossFit gyms don't look like your typical gym. In fact, they're referred to as boxes. And instead of rows of machines, CrossFit Hawaii is mostly open space with a couple of stationary bikes, some pull-up bars and gymnastic rings, and tons of weights. That wide open space with fans blasting wasn't the best for recording. So we filed into a supply closet to talk to Kimo.
In typical CrossFit competitions, everybody's typically divided up by their age range, right? So if you were a CrossFitter that was over 50, usually compete against other 50-year-old or other older athletes. What's the dynamic when these different ages get together? What kind of difference in teamwork and camaraderie do you see in these mixed-age teams as opposed to what you would see if it was all 20-year-olds or all 30-year-olds?
I think for this competition, a lot of people come into it with the aspect of fun. In fact, when people are recruiting, they may not even want to recruit the best 55-plus-year-old because in their mind, hey, we're just here to have fun. And so they're just looking for anybody that's willing to and wants to be on a team. And even though we have workouts that we're going to let people know what they are, everybody's going to do three workouts. There's semifinals and then there's finals. I've heard people say, well, we're just doing it for fun. I hope we don't make it to semifinals because then we'll have to get serious about it. So the difference is not only are there different age groups and that it's all across the board, but people come into the competition with a different attitude of it's just to have fun and not so much it's, well, we got to create the winning team that's going to end up on the podium at the end. So there's going to be people that will take it seriously. I mean, there's always teams that are entering it because they want to do well. We expect more than half, to be just thinking about the fun aspect. They don't feel the pressure. They're going to probably practice a lot and they're going to rehearse and they're going to, once we drop the workouts and they know what they are, they're probably going to spend some time together and do the best they can with the idea that it's still all for fun.
What do you think attracts the 40-plus crowd or the 50-plus crowd to rigorous exercise like CrossFit at an age where we see many other gyms offer classes like yoga or exercises in a pool?
I think it's a lot of people that were athletes before and they enjoy that aspect of their life and they kind of think of it as a memory, but now there's an opportunity. They feel like, hey, I kind of want to do that again. There's always going to be people that are young, 20 or younger, that are not attracted to sports and vigorous workout, but there are people that are. And as people age, I think none of that changes. So yes, the workouts in the pool and the low impact or low intensity are going to attract everybody of all ages. But there's still that crew that when they were in their 20s, they love sports and they love competing. Nothing really changed other than they're older now. And so now they're attracted to workouts that look a little bit more competition-based, challenging-based. People can see what, they can rekindle and refire back up again. So
how would you encourage older adults, older athletes, how would you encourage them to either restart their health and fitness journey or revive or re-challenge themselves with health and fitness?
So I was talking to one of our athletes yesterday, and so he has gotten his diet on point and training back on point, and now he's hit his goal of where he wants to be at. And he said the difference between just a few months ago and now is when I look in the mirror today, I like what I see and I feel happy. As little as 3 months ago, I would look in the mirror and I didn't like what I see. And it made me unhappy and made me think about why do I let myself go and why don't I just get it back again? And so that's what I think would help people. Is like, hey, you can get it back at any age. It doesn't matter if you're in your 30s or 40s or 50s or 70s. You can get back a lot of what is lost as long as you pay attention to it and give consistent time and energy. And if you can find a community that encourages you to do that, where you're not intimidated to go there and it's fun to go there. In fact, you go there to see all your friends, makes it that much easier.
We know what the benefits are. We know how it could be a different scenario for the older athlete. What do the younger athletes learn by being on a team with an older athlete?
I think there's a lot of give and take because I guess the assumption when you hear about the competition is that the young ones will be the ones that are the dominant athletes and the older ones are trying to pick up the slack. There are teams where it's the opposite. The older athletes are the dominant athletes, and the younger athletes are the ones that are going to have to kind of keep up with the older athletes. So there's a give and take on a team, and I think a team finding the strategy based on the workouts that we program, it's programmed specifically to have four different roles. And we're not saying that the oldest person will take the weakest role. There's four different roles of varying capacity, and someone's going to have to take a role. And so ideally, a team will find a mix where hey, all these people fit into the role and can compete equally with the other, and the team can move forward. And the team that has the best mix of players will probably do the best.
You said that this is the second year for WOD for the Ages, but it wasn't your idea. Whose idea was it?
It was Ann Namba.
Ann Namba!
Yeah. So she was the person that sparked it, and I think she tossed it in somebody else's lap, and they said, oh, that's a good idea. Let's run with it. And Shell Silva was that person, I think, she initially tossed it into, and then they, I was the last person to know about it. But then as soon as you hear it, you think, like, that's a great idea. And that's an inclusive competition that's different than the other competitions that are out there.
And so, Anne, now that I've learned that Wad for the Ages started with you, where did the idea come from?
Basically, because I am in the older category and I wanted to compete with the younger people, and this is the only way I could, because there's not that many older people in my age group that I can compete with locally or have the chance to. So,
you're a games athlete, you've competed in the past. What I always am amazed by when I follow your fitness journey is how you just go for it. You're very successful in your professional life and you push yourself to be successful in all areas of your life, including at CrossFit. I mean, for someone as accomplished as you in the fashion world to be a games athlete, I think it's incredible. I think it's an incredible example. What drives you to excel in all areas of your life, especially in your health and fitness journey?
Well, I kind of think that if you're going to do something and invest the time in it, you might as well do the best that you can. So, you know, you just go for it. Why do something mediocre when you can give it your all and your best? So that's what I do.
After the sit-down interview, Kimo showed me and Maddie an example of one of the movements from last year's WOD for the Ages, emphasizing how a team's members had to work collaboratively and play to each other's strengths.
So we coupled people in pairs. There's a higher skill level to a pull-up called a muscle-up. Mm-hmm. Not sure if you've seen it on rings and bars. So while one person was scoring reps on a muscle-up, this athlete had to do a ring hold.
Okay. And what you're doing, you're standing on a 25-pound weight, and you have the rings in front of you. You're at like a 45-degree angle.
It's like a plank. It's like a reverse plank. I'm holding my thumbs to my rib cage, and I have to hold that position. So the person scoring in muscle-ups could only do as many muscle-ups as this person could hold the rings. As soon as they could no longer hold that position of support, then they had to pass it on to the other team.
And you got points based on?
Muscle-ups.
Okay.
Yeah. So sometimes it wasn't the muscle-up athlete. The muscle-up athlete could keep going. This person failed. So then it switched. So it was a team of four, and they worked in pairs.
Okay.
So it was a muscle-up and a ring hold was one way to score. Mm-hmm. As soon as the ring hold finished, then the two people doing pull-ups, they had to do synchronized pull-ups together. Uh-huh. They were chin over bar. I think actually one was chin over bar and one was chest to bar.
Yeah. Chin over bar, chest to bar.
But they had to do it synchronized. So they both had to hit the top position, chin over bar and chest to bar at the same time. So that set up four different levels of capacity that the team had to find. Okay, who is the person going to hold the rings? Mm-hmm. Maybe only one person on the team had muscle-ups. So, of course, that's the person doing that role. One person had chin over bar. The other person had to touch their chest. And it allowed each team member to find their place on the team.
After Kimo's demo, we packed up our equipment and said our thank yous. But before we left, there was one last question I had to answer for myself. Can I still lift?
This may be it. I can already, my body's already like, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay, so.
Awesome.
Good, okay.
Yep, still got it.
That was HPR's Russell Subiono and Maddie Bender talking with CrossFit King, CrossFit Hawaii's Kimo Cockleman and Ann Namba. The WOD for the Ages competition takes place on Saturday, August 3rd. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website later today. That is it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we plan to jump into the world of ukuleles as we mark its arrival to our islands from Portugal. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. Got an ukulele story to share? Call 808-972-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender with help from Savannah Harriman-Pote. Our intern is Alyssa Salcido. Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.